Or is this a certified case? I'm sorry. Yeah. Is the government ready? All right. Let's go.
Morning, Chief Judge Erdman, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Lieutenant James Belforti, and along with Colonel Mark Jameson, I represent the United States. Chief Judge Erdman, with your permission, I would like to preserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. This Court should remand for two reasons. First, it's unclear whether the lower court gave recognition to the fact that the military judge and not the lower court saw and heard the witnesses. Second, the lower court did not apply the proper standard of review to the military judge's non-guilt special findings. Now, with regard to the first issue, the lower court's failure to acknowledge the special findings of the military judge, combined with its failure to explain its stark departure from those findings, evidences its failure to affirmatively recognize that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses. Now, in Turner, this court... Your Honor, I think that emphasizes our point, which is this wasn't them simply overlooking the special findings. It was that the lower court was presumably aware of the special findings, and in spite of that, still didn't acknowledge them on the record and didn't...
I agree with you that if they'd said, in their opinion, we're not looking at the military judge's special findings, or if they'd said, we don't care. We don't care that he saw the witnesses and the evidence. We're not taking that into consideration. If they'd said that, there'd be a problem. But where have we ever said that they have to explain themselves?
We haven't said that. This court hasn't said that, Your Honor. But what I would say is that the requirement to affirmatively make allowances for the fact that they did not personally observe the witnesses in this case requires not just that they acknowledge it, but that in their analysis of the case, it demonstrates that they applied that. Now, in this case, the lower court stated on the record that they made allowances for the fact. But the question here today is really, what is required by the statute?
Well, is this case of first impression here?
I think so, Your Honor.
If it's a case of first impression here, so we haven't spoken on this. So what's the CCA to do when we haven't spoken on it? We haven't said what the standard is. All they know is what statute says, and the statute says make the allowances, and they said we made the allowances. Where does that leave us?
Well, Your Honor, I think the question here is really a question of incantation versus application. Is all that's required?
Well, how can we know?
Because it's this court's duty to give meaning and effect to all the words of the statute. And the question really becomes, what does Turner mean in practicality? What does it mean to make allowances for not having personally observed the witness?
What we've pretty much said is if they're making a determination based on factual sufficiency, we can't do anything at all.
Sorry? Could you repeat that?
If they make a decision based on factual insufficiency, then that's it. The statute doesn't allow us to make factual sufficiency determinations.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. We're not asking.
So why aren't we just stuck with what they did?
Well, because we're not asking this court to determine that the facts were sufficient. We're asking this court to determine whether the law was applied properly to those facts, particularly the Turner test and the requirement of the statute to make allowances for not having personally observed the witnesses.
They said that they did.
But that statement is belied by the way they treated the facts in this case.
Because, which gets back to you, you don't think that they treated the facts correctly, which is something we can't review.
I think this court can review whether the law was applied properly. Whether or not the ultimate determination was that it's factually sufficient is something that this court can't review. So it's not, sorry.
It's okay. I have another question. I came into work this morning quite early, and someone blindsided me by saying, what do you think about the fact that this operates as a functional equivalent of an acquittal and that it's barred by double jeopardy? Have you considered that, or are you ready to discuss that?
I'll try my best, Your Honor. I think that this court's ruled on that issue in Leak, in which the court said that it's not the functional equivalent of an acquittal, and therefore the double jeopardy concerns aren't there. I think if we're talking about Evans v. Michigan, I would also point out that this court has routinely ruled that hasn't found a lack of jurisdiction when the United States has challenged whether or not the lower court has properly conducted its factual sufficiency review. So I don't think Evans v. Michigan or the double jeopardy clause bars the United States' certification in this case.
Based on Leak?
Based on Leak, primarily. I would also point out that since Evans v. Michigan, which I think was a 2013 case, came out, this court issued a summary denial in Soto, but notably this court didn't say that it lacked jurisdiction because of the double jeopardy clause.
I'll ask you one more question. I promise I'll stop. The defendant makes the point that you being the government, often says in response to their complaint that something wasn't explained by the CCA, that, well, there's a presumption that they know the law and follow the law, and there's a presumption of regularity. Why, when that's an argument you make all the time, shouldn't you be held to that same argument when you would like to make the opposite argument?
I think we can be held to that, but I think in this case we overcome that presumption based on the way the lower court treated the facts. And I think maybe a good example of that would be with regard to the experts. So, for example, the military judge made a special finding about the relative credibility of the two experts and gave reasons for crediting one over the other. Now, the lower court said kind of bluntly that there was nothing in the record to support the testimony over one or the other.
I don't think they said he was credible. I think they found his position to be dogmatic, which is really nothing to do with credibility, is it?
Well, the military judge said it was unduly dogmatic, which is why he didn't credit it, along with...
But dogmatic isn't uncredible.
I think, Your Honor...
Dogmatic is you take a position and you stick to it more than the military judge thinks that you should.
I think, Your Honor, dogmatic actually says a lot here, because I think it conveys stubbornness, and that's something that might not be just conveyed by a cold record. I think that's something that's also conveyed by demeanor, and that takes us back to the point, which is that it's the military judge in this case who's in a superior position to make those determinations, things that cannot necessarily be communicated via a cold record. So when the military judge gets to evaluate the credibility, even of experts, he's seeing things in addition to just hearing what they're testifying to. He's seeing their demeanor. He's seeing how they respond to their positions being challenged. And if one expert isn't willing to give any ground and is stubbornly holding on to his position, that can affect his credibility. And I think that's something that the military judge properly seized on here. And that's in stark contrast to the fact the lower court clearly didn't credit this at all. And it's not just that they didn't credit it. It's that it's not reflected in the record. To say that there's nothing in the record to support one over the other, that's just incorrect. I mean, the military judge found there was something. They may disagree with that. But to say that is just simply incorrect. And I think that gives further evidence of them failing to make allowances for not having personally observed the witnesses. So I think that, coming back to your original question, Your Honor, it's that overcomes the presumption of regularity here.
Well, is it that they failed to make allowances, or that they made allowances and you lost?
I think it's that they failed to make allowances, Your Honor, because it's not just whether or not the lower court got it right. The question is whether or not the lower court did it right. Did they perform their function correctly?
But here the statute says that they have to take into account that the trial court heard and saw the witnesses. Here the CCA said that specifically. They took into account that they didn't hear and see the witnesses. And so we've said in Washington very succinctly that that's all they need to do. We've also said that the CCA doesn't have to detail the reason for all of their decisions, a position the government takes all the time up here. So it looks like you're asking us for a pretty broad, sweeping new rule.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, and I don't think that in Washington this court held that all that was required to satisfy Turner and the statute is merely to copy and paste the standard of Turner. I think that more is required under the statute. It can't just be a copy and paste job, because in this case, saying we made allowances for this and then analyzing it in a way that demonstrates that they clearly didn't is a problem.
Well, let me read you what Washington said. It said, such review involves a fresh, impartial look at the evidence, giving no deference to the decision of the trial court on factual sufficiency beyond the admonition to take into account the fact that the trial court heard and saw the witnesses. That seems pretty clear to me.
Your Honor, I would emphasize two things in that quote. First of all, no deference to the decision, and I think that's important here because it's still a de novo review. It's still a de novo review of the ultimate decision, but there's no deference to the decision, and then there's the statement beyond the admonition. So it's an admonition, and this court found it's active, both in Turner and Washington, to make allowances for, to take into account that.
That's what the statute says, counsel, and it's what they said that they did. So unless you'd like us to somehow discern from this thing that they are lying to us, okay, what you're really at the end of the day complaining about is that you disagree with what they did, which means that you think that they got the factual sufficiency issue wrong, which is something we can't review.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. It's not about the ultimate conclusion. Obviously, that's what gets it into this court, but them saying it and then not doing it is not giving meaning and effect to the last 10 words of the statute. And that's
what. But the reason that you're saying that they didn't do it is because they came out the way that they did.
It's true, Your Honor, but any challenge under factual sufficiency made by the government is going to be a case in which it was found to be factually insufficient. That doesn't mean that the government's position is automatically barred. If it were, then we wouldn't even be able to get into this court. I mean, that's what this court.
Yeah, you just certify.
But Your Honor, I would point out that Soto, for example, was a challenge in the same vein, and there were no oral arguments in that case. It was a summary decision. It's a different scenario, and
maybe
I think
we're bored.
Sorry.
Maybe we're bored.
Well, I hope I'm being more entertaining than Your Honor.
Counsel, would it be your position then that the only time that a CCA has handled it appropriately, in the government's view, is if the CCA agrees with this? Special findings of a military judge?
Not at all, Your Honor. And that's why the United States cited to the line of cases in the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. And that's why we sub-cited to Cruz just recently.
So what would need to happen? Here we've got the CCA saying, we've taken consideration of this point. Now the government disagrees, and so they've certified the case. But what more would have to happen?
In my opinion, Your Honor, I think similar to what the Army Court did in House, for example, explaining, okay, we recognize that this turned on credibility, and we recognize the statements of the witness on the stand, but here are the points where we disagree with, and here's why. Or, for example, in Cruz, where the lower court says they're departing from the factual sufficiency determination, finding it factually insufficient, and stating, it doesn't matter that we didn't see or hear the witnesses here, because what we're ultimately evaluating is a videotape. So if we're evaluating a video, we are in the same vantage point as the lower court. So in this case, obviously, they're not evaluating videotape, but I think something similar to House would be more preferable, would actually give life and meaning to the statute.
So getting back to Judge Stuckey's point, though, we've never said that before. So we're just going to now create this new requirement out of language that simply says recognizing in the statute?
Your Honor, I think that it would just be giving life to the Turner test, and this court has never answered the question, what does it mean in practicality to make allowances for not having personally observed the witnesses? Does it mean just say that you realize that, or does it mean actually applying that test?
Is it a test at all, or is it, as the Chief Judge pointed out, an admonition to govern factual sufficiency review and not really a legal test at all?
Well, Your Honor,
standard.
However you want to call it, a standard, I think that it's an affirmative requirement, and that's something that the court, with the words make allowances for, take into account that. Those are affirmative requirements on the court. And the issue here is the affirmative requirement just to write something down and then do whatever you want? And the United States' position is that that's not what it is. That cannot be what the Congress intended.
I think you're being rather cavalier when you suggest that the CCAs are just mouthing words and then doing whatever they want. I think that's pretty disrespectful.
Well, I don't mean to be disrespectful, Your Honor. I think the issue.
And if they say that they did something, right? I mean, even if they had said nothing at all, right? Wouldn't there be a presumption of regularity that they'd done so? And given the fact that they affirmatively stated that they did, had your petition for reconsideration where you complained that they hadn't, denied your petition for reconsideration en banc, how can you come up here and argue that they didn't do it?
Your Honor, because I think the fact that they denied our reconsideration illustrates the point. It wasn't simply that the lower court overlooked special findings. It was that the lower court was aware of the special findings and didn't give them their due consideration, their due regard.
Didn't agree with you.
Didn't give them the consideration you would give them, but it's their job to do that.
Your Honor, it's not the consideration I would give them. It's a consideration I think the Congress wants them to
give. It seems to me, counsel, that your position here today is that unless they had found the same findings as the military judge did here, that they must not have considered his findings and therefore abdicated the responsibility under the statute.
No, Your Honor. I would say that, for example, with regard to the experts, if the lower court had said something akin to, realized the military judge saw the experts, we realize that he credited Dr. Henry over Dr. Greer for these reasons, here's why we do not, here's why we depart, here's why we disagree, that would have been a proper application of the words.
Do they have to do that in every factual sufficient review, in your view, from now on?
No, Your Honor, if it comes down to departing from a key issue, like in this case, the lower court seized on that as a key issue, which was the credibility of the two experts. So if they're characterizing it that way and they're going to depart from a finding of the military judge who illustrated the finding and found it specially, I think in those situations it's probably incumbent on the court to do a little bit more than what they did here.
And that would be reversible error from here on out.
Your Honor, I don't think that this is a new standard that would completely overturn the factual sufficiency analysis the way this court has applied it.
Well, isn't it the government's contention that two other CCAs are imposing a particular standard and that the Navy Court erred in not imposing the same standard? And now you're up here saying, well, we're not necessarily.
With regard to the first issue, I'm talking about, with regard to the first certified issue, the question of what the last 10 words mean, I think that's simply giving life to the Turner test. That's not overturning the apple cart. Now, with regard to the second issue, the clearly erroneous issue, I don't think there's anything incompatible with applying a clearly erroneous standard to a de novo review. And that seems to be the point of departure. And I see my time is running out here.
I have one other question, which is, so just taking your position in the interest of fairness, so from now on, when the CCA says that issues a per curiam decision saying that we find that the case is legally, factually sufficient, affirmed, that shouldn't be good enough. We should require them to explain to us in complete detail why they've reached the decision that they have.
I don't think that's always going to be necessary, Your Honor, because I think in those situations, implicit in that decision would be a recognition that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses and a giving considerable weight to the superior position of the lower court. Obviously, that's beneficial to the United States, but that's the way the statute's written, is that to recognize that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses. So that's our position on that. But I think
so it works if they affirm the conviction, but that same recognition doesn't work if they reverse it?
Not necessarily. I think
that's what you've just basically said. But you can respond on rebuttal.
Okay.
More to say on it.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Major Brian McGee. Together with Mr. David Sheldon, I represent Airman Dustin Clark. In an unremarkable and straightforward application of Article 66C, the NMCCA was left unconvinced of Airman Clark's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The certified issues in this case represent merely a factual disagreement with the NMCCA dressed up as a legal argument. The NMCCA properly conducted a full Article 66C analysis and review. It cited the correct standard, it cited the correct test, and then it applied it to the facts of this case.
Counsel, are you suggesting we don't have jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that the court does not have jurisdiction.
Well, you just said it's a factual sufficiency case dressed up and tricked up in other garb. If it's a pure factual sufficiency case, why do we have jurisdiction?
Because
I know the TJAG sent it here, but it's for us to decide whether we've got jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. The issues that were certified are legal issues.
I understand that.
But at the heart of the issue is a mere disagreement on facts.
Okay. Regardless of what CCA may have done, and I realize that this is a factual sufficiency case, how can we exercise any sort of meaningful appellate review if they don't tell us what they did or what standard they applied?
Your Honor, all that's required by the statute is that the CCA recognized that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses. The weight that matters in a particular case is something that's completely within the purview of the lower court. Just like at trial, the amount of weight or the amount of weight that the members may give a particular piece of evidence is something completely within the purview of the members. That same principle is true here, Your Honor.
So in other words, it's really standardless. It's really the chancellor's foot.
It's not a standard, Your Honor. It's a requirement that it's something that they're required to consider.
That gets me back to my original question, which is maybe we weren't intended to exercise meaningful appellate review here, but if we are, it's kind of hard if they don't say what they did or how they did it.
Go ahead. Counsel, earlier in the government's argument, Judge Ryan asked about their views on the possible double jeopardy aspects in this case. Have you had a chance to take a look at that and respond?
A little bit, Your Honor, and that's something that was that I addressed a little bit in the response in the opposition to the motion to reconsider. That the issues that were certified are technically questions of law. So I think that this court has the ability to consider those questions. Now, if the court adopts the government's position and finds that there was error, then I think any remedy ordered by this court could potentially violate the principles of double jeopardy.
Well, I'm moving back a little bit further. Since the CCA has essentially issued an acquittal based on factual sufficiency, once that acquittal is in effect, and it is in effect, isn't anything further double jeopardy?
Your Honor, I recognize that the lower court, that CCA opinions are inchoate, I believe, until the mandate is issued. But
the ruling itself,
and that's where the double
the acquittal is there.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's something that this court, and again, I addressed it a little bit in the motion to reconsider because that's what the government was asking, was that it be reconsidered by a different panel. In fact, if it were sent back here today, two of the judges on this panel have retired, so Airman Clark could not get the same panel. So certainly those, whether it technically bars this court's consideration of the legal issues, to send it back for a reconsideration would certainly implicate.
Under Evans, it doesn't matter if there was legal error, right? I mean, Evans says we don't care if the basis for the acquittal was completely erroneous as a matter of law.
That's true, Your Honor.
Right? So, I mean, if it applied, but do you think it should? I mean, is there anything that's happened since we decided Leak that would lead us to change that precedent?
There has been at least one Supreme Court decision that's not something I've researched in depth.
Totally fair.
But there has been at least one recent Supreme Court decision that tangentially at least addresses some of those issues, Your Honor. The government asks this court to adopt a position that would require the CCA to be bound by the special findings of the military judge unless clearly erroneous. But that's not the purpose of special findings. The purpose of special findings are to preserve for appeal issues of law for review, not to constrain or circumscribe the ability of the CCA to conduct its factual sufficiency review. It's much like a math problem where in school children have to show not just their answer, but how they got there. It's not just that they got a particular answer, but their work has to be correct. And on factual sufficiency review, the CCA is not in the position of simply checking the military judge's work. It's in the position of doing the work itself. It's an independent de novo review.
But once special findings are issued, I mean, you're not arguing that they can only then later be used for the benefit of the accused. I mean, it seems to me that you're kind of arguing that, well, they asked for them, and one of the purposes for them is to protect the accused.
Yes, Your Honor.
But once a military judge issues special findings, it would seem that they're wide open. They can be used by either party for whatever purpose.
By either party, yes, Your Honor, but not for whatever purpose, specifically to review legal issues.
Well, yes.
But not factual issues.
Are you saying then Article 51 was not influenced by Federal Criminal Procedure 23C, where special findings really are not so much to preserve legal issues, it's a judge actually is making findings of fact?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct, but and it absolutely is based on the federal rule, but the federal civilian system does not have de novo factual sufficiency review. It only has legal sufficiency review, where the standard, if there were no special findings, the standard would be to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the government. But where there are special findings in military judge alone cases, we don't have to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, because we have the special findings to review to make sure that the military judge or the federal judge found the accused guilty in the right way, applying the correct presumptions, defenses, and that type of thing. So it's to preserve or to be able to affect legal review, not factual sufficiency review, Your Honor. If this court adopts the government's position, it should not overlook the numerous consequences. First and foremost, that would effectively kill de novo factual sufficiency review in military judge alone cases. It would put the accused in a position of, if he elects to go military judge alone, or just simply by electing to go military judge alone, potentially forfeiting one right over the other. For example, the accused would have to be put in a position of electing, do I want to choose to request special findings so that I can preserve the appellate court's ability to conduct a full and complete factual sufficiency review and make sure that the military judge convicted me in the correct way, and thereby forfeit my right to de novo factual sufficiency review because the military judge is bound by those findings unless clearly erroneous? Or do I want to forfeit my ability to make sure that the military judge did his job correctly so that I can preserve factual sufficiency review? And worse, because in our system, it's not just the accused that gets to make that determination. Any party, upon request, the military judge is required to make special findings. So the government may then be the one that gets to choose which right the accused is going to forfeit, or the military judge who can sua sponte enter special findings. When Airman Clark waived his right to trial by members, he could have never imagined that he would also waive his right to a de novo factual sufficiency review. Finally, as this court recognized in Washington, and particularly as Judge Sullivan quoted in his concurrence in part, this court has never attached any undue significance to the last 10 words of Article 66C. Rather, it's generally considered it a simple admonition or caution. The court should do so in this case. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Government?
Mr. Honor, I just want to make a few quick points. Seizing on what my colleague just said, that this court has never attached any significance to the last 10 words of 66C, that's exactly the issue, is what are the significance of the last 10 words of 66C, and what is their meaning and effect? This court shouldn't just render them surplusage by equating them to an incantation requirement. With regard to my colleague's argument about the clearly erroneous standard, it's all based on the premise that applying clearly erroneous standard to non-guilt special findings is completely incompatible with a de novo review. I respectfully disagree with that. I think that we've done that in the past, particularly in UCI cases, for example. There's still a de novo review while applying a clearly erroneous standard to findings of fact, non-guilt special findings. So the deference, the no deference standard of Washington, is to the decision of the trial court. So there's no deference to the ultimate conclusion. guilty or not guilty. But as to the findings that got him or her there.
They're just making this up. I mean, this is brand new.
Your Honor, I think it mirrors the practice in the civilian practice, which is what...
Civilian practice is completely different. They don't get to do... They don't do the same thing, counsel, as the CCA.
If the,
they don't get to substitute their judgment for the judgment of the members or the trial judge.
Your Honor, I think if Article 51D and 66C were inherently incompatible in that way, the Congress would have carved out some sort
the
of exception.
The structures are completely different.
Sorry?
The structures are completely different.
Your Honor,
the systems are completely different. The function of the CCA and the function of a circuit court of appeals are completely different.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think that the... If they were somehow incompatible and an exception needed to be carved out, then the Congress would have done something about that or the President would have done something about that in 918. Since there isn't anything in either the statute or the rule, I think this Court should presume that they can work together and that they do work together and that that doesn't rob the CCA of their ability to conduct a de novo review. That's the United States' position.
How do you do a de novo review as to result but give deference to the military judge's findings, which is presumably a subsection of this de novo review?
Because, Your Honor, so for example, if in a case like this where there are 5 or 10 or whatever non-guilt special findings in the military judge, it is possible that the CCA could say we find that clearly erroneous or we find all of these not to be clearly erroneous, that notwithstanding, we still do not agree with the ultimate conclusion. We are still not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt.
But again, counsel, you're making this up for the very first time. Right? You're making this up for the very first time. It's never been the law. It's never been the rule. The statute specifically says that we can review what they do based on questions of law. It says nothing about us doing anything about their decisions on questions of fact. And while I understand that you would like us to, it's brand new and you're making it up.
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. Can I
please respond?
Thank you. Your Honor, I think that the question of what is the standard of review that should be applied to non-guilt special findings of fact is a question that this Court hasn't answered yet. So that's that
never
is
been asked it.
And that's why we're asking it, Your Honor. So that is why I would agree with you that it's brand new, but just because it's brand new, we don't feel that it's incorrect. That concludes my argument. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. The court thanks counsel for both parties, and the court will be in recess until 10:15.